From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We're living in a remarkable age of scientific discovery. In just the last decade, biologists have pieced together the evolutionary histories of hundreds of animals, and geneticists are now uncovering various hereditary risks that could kill us. But not everyone's happy with how this new stockpile of DNA data is being used. Take the novelist Michael Crichton. He says it's been a terrible mistake to allow the genes in our own bodies to be patented.
If I own the gene, I can prevent anyone from doing anything else with that gene. You can't publish it. You can't test for it. You can't do research on it without my permission. That's crazy.
Today, we'll explore the frontiers of DNA research. We'll also talk with a controversial Nobel Prize winner, James Watson, co-discoverer of DNA's double helix. He says young scientists need a bit of arrogance.
You should expect young people to be arrogant if they have a bright idea and no one else believes in them. They got to convince themselves and then maybe a few others they're on the right track.
But first, a story about a seemingly routine medical test that had enormous consequences.
It was about a year after my mother passed away from ovarian cancer, and I had, on a whim, taken a test for the BRCA mutation. I really took it just to ensure that I had a clean bill of health. I never thought that I would test positive because there was no history of cancer in our family other than my mother, as far as I knew. And I was at work on the Warner Brothers lot. I was writing for the show The Gilmore Girls at the time. It was just an ordinary morning. I was, you know, writing my rent check and answering phone calls, and on my list was call the medical lab.
And when Jessica Queller did call the lab, she got the shock of her life. She'd tested positive for the dreaded BRCA mutation, the so-called breast cancer gene. That test ultimately led to an agonizing decision. Should she have both her breasts removed, strictly as a preventive measure? The decision was especially hard because Jessica, a TV scriptwriter, was only 34 years old, still single, and she wanted a family. Queller tells the story in her book, Pretty is What Changes. Anne Strainchamps asked how she reacted to the news that she'd tested positive.
At first, I was in denial. Since I wasn't prepared to test positive and I so foolishly thought that I would be negative, once I got the results, I wasn't prepared to deal with them. So I stuck the lab report into a drawer and shut it and blocked it out for 3 months. I had some vague notion in my mind that since my mother hadn't developed breast cancer until age 52, that I wouldn't really have to worry about it for at least a decade, since I was 34 when I got the test results. A friend of mine felt that I was being irrational in my playing ostrich. So she did some research on her own, and she called me and was very bossy and said, "You are in denial. This is a big thing, and you need to face it." And I spoke to a breast surgeon who said, "You really need to have a double mastectomy." And I was terribly upset, and I didn't want to deal with it. I wanted a family. I was dating. I thought that's something I would never consider. I became quite upset.
So as you thought about, I mean, I know this was an agonizing decision. Did it eventually come to seem like a no-brainer, like, you know, yes, breasts are nice, but which do I care about more, keeping my breasts or staying alive? Or did you sort of think, I don't know, I mean, they can treat a lot of cancers now, maybe it'd be better to wait?
It was never a no-brainer. It was always a struggle. It was always an agonizing decision. It took me a year from the time I tested positive until the time I actually did the surgery. And I spent every hour of every day of that year grappling with what to do. It weighed very heavily on me to have the surgery. I had a lot of fears that I would feel deformed afterwards, that I would feel unattractive, that I wouldn't want to be touched, that men might not find me attractive. It was a very heavy decision, but after witnessing my mother's horrific battle with cancer, there was no question ultimately that getting cancer would be worse than having the surgery for me.
Did it ever strike you as kind of odd or bizarre, the kind of attachments we have to breasts. You got an awful lot of really very visceral responses from people, other people, you know, from people who read an op-ed piece you wrote about it in the Times to, you know, friends and family. And it's just, I imagine the strength of people's reactions, both positive and negative, made it in some ways that much harder to make your own decision. But did it ever seem odd that people had such strong reactions?
It seemed very odd. I was so surprised by the fierceness of people's opinions. And I think it really strikes a very personal chord in people. I think that this subject taps into something everyone imagines themselves in this situation and projects what they would do. And people were incredibly judgmental.
What sort of things did people write to you and say to you?
Well, a lot of people posted responses to the op-ed piece I wrote. Also, I did an interview on Nightline with Cokie Roberts. And by the time I did the interview, I had announced my decision to go forward with a prophylactic mastectomy. And people wrote in saying, "Jessica, don't do it. I beg you." One man responded after hearing me speak on Nightline that he couldn't imagine any woman making that decision, and he equated it with being castrated.
Yeah, those are pretty strong responses.
Yeah, they're pretty strong. There were, of course, there were many sympathetic people, especially cancer survivors and other women in the situation who said, "Bravo, of course, take any action you can to avoid this horrible disease."
Mm. Well, what about you? I mean, this is sort of an invasive question, I guess, but how attached were you to your breasts? How important were they to you?
Well, I had quite an ambivalent relationship with my breasts. This is such an odd topic to discuss, but I'm sort of a petite woman. My shoulders are narrow, and I had quite large breasts. I was a 32D, and I always felt that my breasts were sort of too large for my frame. So there was a part of me that thought, well, I never would have had a breast reduction, but, you know, this is a good excuse to downsize to a size B and make myself more in proportion. So that was the unexpected silver lining, which I did end up doing. But that said, you know, the concept of removing your breasts and having fake implants and reconstructing that sort of intimate part of your body is scary. And thankfully, those fears were totally unfounded. And plastic surgery is amazing today. It's so advanced, and they put you back together very beautifully. And I feel totally normal and comfortable in my new body. So,
yeah, reading your book, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know how advanced reconstructive surgery is today. You have some lovely stories about some of the very first women you met, including the very first woman you met who had had reconstructive surgery and asked if you wanted to see her breasts.
I met my friend Susie. She was a friend of a friend, and she had been through the surgery about a year or so before I was considering doing it. And we met in Los Angeles at a Coffee Bean in Larchmont. And we talked for about an hour and a half. And she shared her whole story and how difficult it was for her to make the decision and how happy she was with the results and how relieved she was that she no longer had this cancer threat looming over her head. And then she asked if I'd like to see her reconstruction, and I'd known her for only an hour, and I was so touched. And we went into a clothing store next door, into a dressing room, and she took her shirt off, and it was just so moving and so generous, and she looked gorgeous. And I was amazed because I think I, like many people, have some idea about mastectomy from my grandmother's generation and my mother's generation of something very frightening. And
like you'll have to wear a turtleneck the rest of your life.
Not at all. She wore a tank top to show off to me how free she was and how she could wear anything. And she looked gorgeous.
So you did go ahead and decide to have and had the surgery, the double mastectomy. And are you happy with the end results now?
Absolutely. I feel fine. I mean, there are some scars, but they're fading, and I don't even think about it, really. That's the strange part. And all of the women I know who've gone through this, and I've spoken with many, everyone agrees that the fear at the beginning in anticipation was by far the worst. And the result afterwards was really quite fine.
Hmm. We haven't talked about ovarian cancer at all, but that's the other issue that the BRCA test raised. It's what your mother actually died of. And the test you took showed that you had a 47% or so chance of developing ovarian cancer yourself. How have you approached making a decision about whether or not to have your ovaries removed?
Well, if I had already had my children, doctors would have advised me to have my ovaries removed at 35. Since I want biological children and I'm 38, I haven't had a child, the oncologists feel that it's a prudent age to have your ovaries removed at 40. So my plan is to have the oophorectomy at around age 40, and I am going to try to have a baby in the next 2 years before then.
So you're pursuing artificial insemination, or, I mean, will you try to have a baby by yourself?
I was in a relationship for a year after the surgery, and it didn't work out for the normal reasons that relationships mm-hmm. don't work out, having nothing to do with my BRCA situation. And at that point, when we broke up, I was 37 and a half. And I realized at that time that, you know, for me to start dating again, start from scratch with the pressure, you know, foremost on my mind that I need to get pregnant right away, I felt that that would put my love life in an untenable situation, that I just felt it wasn't a fair position for myself or anyone else. So I made the decision.
It's kind of a pressure cooker.
It's an unfair stress on any new relationship. I didn't want to do that. So I made the decision after a lot of soul searching as well that I was going to pursue being a single mother, having a baby through an anonymous donor, and then worry about love later. So that's what I'm doing.
Right.
Jessica Queller talked with Anne Strainchamps about her book, Pretty is What Changes. So, what would you do if you were in Jessica's shoes? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Michael Crichton is famous for his string of thrillers, from The Andromeda Strain and Jurassic Park to his recent bestseller, Next. Many of his fictional plots revolve around cutting-edge science, which is not surprising, considering Crichton's background. He got an MD from Harvard Medical School and was a postdoc at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. What you may not realize is that Crichton is also deeply troubled by certain scientific trends. It's why he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about the problems with allowing patents on our DNA.
What happened was that the patent office, which is essentially, I guess, 18th century institution, now moving its way into the 21st century awkwardly and dealing with new technologies badly, made a mistake and started granting patents for genes. And at this point now, something like 20% of the genome is owned, and the results are disastrous.
How would this happen? Say somebody patents a part of the genome. What's the practical effect of that?
Well, you now own a little bit of nature, and you can do whatever you want with it. You can prevent other people from doing research. You can stop research. You can prevent people from testing for the gene. You can charge as much as you want so that, for example, a gene test, generally speaking, costs in the area of $30 to $100. I mean, actually, gene testing is quite inexpensive. And if it were freely available, it would be much less than that. You could test for thousands of genes in a single drop of blood, for example. The breast cancer genes cost $3,000. And so there are people who are looking at this. If they're not covered by insurance, they're saying, well, you know, I don't know if I can do the test and also afford the cost of a mastectomy, so I'll just go and do the mastectomy. And they remove their breasts without the benefit of having had this gene test first because it's so expensive.
And you're saying it's expensive because somebody owns the patent to the gene. So the test that should cost $50 costs $3,000 and somebody's making money when the intent of all of this all along was for science to be furthered and for health to be protected.
Exactly right. You see, it's different from other kinds of patenting. If I make a mousetrap or an MP3 player, if I have an iPod, you can make your MP3 player too. It can't be exactly like mine, but if I have a wooden mousetrap, you can make a titanium one. You can do something else. You can make a better one. The problem with gene patenting is that if I own the gene, I can prevent anyone from doing anything else with that gene. You can't publish it. You can't test for it. You can't do research on it without my permission. You can't search for mutations of the gene unless I permit it. It's a real roadblock to research, and it's had very severe effects beyond just raising costs.
We've been through some of the arguments on this with regard to the development of pharmaceuticals. Companies say that they have a right, after having put in all of the effort to develop a particular drug, to charge more money for it to try to recoup their costs. Is there anything like that going on with the discovery of and patenting of genes?
No, actually, this is different. The equivalent argument, I think, when you compare it to pharmaceuticals is this is like giving a patent on high blood pressure. So whoever has the patent on high blood pressure can control any drugs related to high blood pressure. They can prevent people from making drugs because they own high blood pressure. And it's a really very different situation. No one owns high blood pressure. So there are, I don't know, 20 high blood pressure medications that work in different ways. And they can be priced competitively if that's the situation, if somebody wants to do that. And there's the opportunity for the classic competition that we all think is so important. Gene patents prevent the competition.
You cite another example that I found particularly disturbing. This is the Canavan disease.
Mm-hmm.
The people who developed it actually thought that they were developing and paying for research that was going to be freely available, right?
That's right. It's a horrible story, really. Canavan disease is an inherited disease of Ashkenazi populations. It's a fatal illness in children. It develops around 3 months. It becomes visible. The children have seizures. They have mental retardation, and they all die by adolescence. So it's uniformly fatal, and it's just, as you can imagine, heart-rending for the parents who have to go through this. A family named Greenberg had two such children, and that was because there was no test. And they set out to make a test available for other people around the world so that no one would have to suffer through this disease again. And they found a researcher who had worked on Tay-Sachs, a related gene that had been discovered and the test was available. And they contributed money. They found patients around the world. They really worked hard. And the goal of it was to have a free test for whoever wanted it. And what happened was that the institution that the researcher was at patented the gene and didn't make the test available without paying a royalty.
What's even worse, I gather, is that the parents were given the opportunity to also participate in the royalties from this, but refused because they wanted it to be free, not understanding that by doing so, they were simply giving up any participation in it.
Right. They actually, what they refused to do was to become co-owners of the gene. And had they done that, they would have had some leverage about what happened. But they believe, and I think rightly, that no one should own a gene.
What does the research institute say? How do they justify that action?
Well, I think you have to look at it the other way around. If the patent office will allow the patenting of genes, I mean, it's a sort of truth of intellectual property. I've worked in intellectual property my whole life. So, for example, of course I would copyright Jurassic Park. But if I'm allowed broader ownership, I'll take it. If I could copyright all dinosaur stories, I would do that. If I could copyright all rampaging animal stories, I'd do that. If I could copyright all stories taking place on an island, I'll do that. And the problem is that once the patent office said, okay, we're going to allow the patenting of genes, it would be very unwise, you know, as the Canavan story shows, not to take the patents. But that doesn't mean that that's what should have happened in the first place.
I understand that you are a doctor, not a lawyer, a writer, not a politician. In response to your editorial, though, there was a response from a research professor at a law school who said that this is nothing new, that Judge Learned Hand in 1911 established that patents could be issued, and I'm quoting him, on the isolated and purified versions of substances occurring naturally in the body. So I guess this is not new.
I don't really think that's accurate. I think that's another legal argument. The core issue is whether or not you can patent a fact of nature. And the notion, for example, that if you have a child now, if that child is a woman, she grows up and she's concerned about breast cancer, not only does she have to pay $3,000 to somebody, but she also cannot give the gene inside her own body to another researcher to study. She's not free to dispose of parts of her body, to give them away, to do other things, because someone else owns them. That's crazy. Just the way it's crazy that people now own diseases. Somebody owns hepatitis C. You know, if you want to study it, if you want to do tests on it, there was somebody in Los Angeles, a sort of benefactor who wanted to test homeless people for hepatitis C in order that they could get treatment and so on and so on. And the owner of the gene blocked it.
Said he didn't want the research done?
Didn't want the test done without paying a royalty, which the person said, you know, this is a, I'm doing this as a public service. I don't want to pay for it. And they said, I'm sorry.
It's sort of hard to believe, isn't it?
The National Academy of Sciences looked at this problem and came up with some clear understanding that, for example, something like half of all university researchers have asked colleagues, other professors, for data regarding genes and so on, and have been refused. One quarter of all labs doing medical testing have stopped tests that they're conducting because of concerns about patents. When you have something like SARS, where there's potentially a pandemic that's going to affect the entire world, turns out scientists were very reluctant to study that disease because there were pending patent problems. They weren't sure whether they were going to get in trouble for doing the research. This is crazy. You have a disease that's 10 times as deadly as bubonic plague, and people won't study it because of patent concerns?
That's writer Michael Crichton, whose best-selling novels include The Andromeda Strain and Jurassic Park. Coming up, fossil genes, convergent evolution, and other remarkable stories from the frontiers of biology. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
If you think of DNA as a text with this really simple alphabet, as you read through the text, lots of pieces of the text make sense, and those are genes.
And decoding those genes has ignited a revolution in modern biology. It's one of the great underreported stories in all of science. How far evolutionary biology has advanced in just the last couple of decades. One scientist at the forefront of this work is University of Wisconsin evolutionary biologist Sean Carroll, author of the book The Making of the Fittest: DNA and the Ultimate Forensic Record of Evolution. He told Steve Paulson that scientists have uncovered all kinds of fascinating nuggets of evolutionary history. For instance, fossil genes in species that have moved out of their original habitats.
So imagine, for example, a fish whose ancestors swam in shallow water on a coral reef, but now in chasing food supply and changing water temperatures and things like that, has now gone to live in deeper water where there's less light. That sort of change in habitat means that some of the genes that were useful to its ancestors are no longer needed. And what happens is, and this is another facet of this process of natural selection, is that when they at random are mutated, nothing happens. Those mutations just continue to accumulate and accumulate. And these can be in the hundreds of genes in any individual, and humans have hundreds of these as well.
So these genes that are still there but not used anymore, not functional anymore, those are what you call fossil genes.
That's what we're calling fossil genes. And the idea of a fossil gene is that it's sort of sitting there much as a fossil sits in rock, sort of eroding out over the course of time. And then we can capture fossil genes that are millions of years old in virtually any species.
So what you're saying then is that gives an incredible glimpse or window onto the past, onto how this still living species, what its ancestors were.
Yeah, how is it different from its ancestors? So this carrying around of, you know, these relics of the past or these little broken pieces of yesterday's lifestyle, we weren't really thinking about this, I think, in terms of, you know, evolutionary theory, you know, 40 years ago or something like that, because it just wasn't, you know, on our minds whatsoever.
Well, let's talk about vision for a moment, because this is an area that I know a lot of research has been done on. And it's fascinating when you actually start to compare different species in terms of color. For instance, humans have a pretty good color spectrum, don't they?
Right. So how we perceive the world, it's called trichromatic vision. We can sort of see across the spectrum from blue to red. And that capability came about somewhere in our primate history. It turns out that other mammals do not have that full color spectrum. All old world primates have this full color vision. Ecological studies show that that seems to be really important. It helps them distinguish red from green in the forest, or red and yellow from green. That's really helpful because those are the younger, more nutritious leaves. Hmm. Riper fruits tend to be in the yellow-red range versus green. And so it makes a lot of common sense that being able to see a wider hue of colors would be some sort of advantage.
If it's an advantage, you'd think that all animal species would have evolved this trait to have this full color
spectrum.
Well,
and it turns out birds generally have this broad spectrum of sensitivity, even fish, especially, as I was mentioning, fish that live in shallow water, bright light, reef fish. It just turns out that the common ancestor of all mammals did not have full color vision. There's considerable speculation that that's because it may have been a nocturnal animal, and it wasn't using much daylight vision. When primates whose ancestor had full color vision, when those primates go nocturnal, like something like the owl monkey, these genes are inactivated again. They become fossil genes. So again, there's this close linkage between the habitats that animals live in and the color vision genes that they have. They're gaining in certain habitats, losing in others, or shifting around. I think one of the most spectacular shifts is the ability of birds to see in the ultraviolet. Now, that's not all birds, but certain groups of birds have evolved the capability to see what we can't see, shorter wavelength light than blue, the ultraviolet range. So it's used to find certain prey that reflect in ultraviolet light. It's also used, some young chicks, they have reflecting colors around their mouths that reflect in the ultraviolet, so that helps the mother feed the chicks in the dark. And there are feather patterns that you and I can't see, but are visible in ultraviolet. So they reflect certain colors off the feathers, and these are used as mating cues in certain groups of birds.
Now, you were saying that old world primates have this full color vision, but not new world primates, with one exception. The new world is meaning South America, Central America.
Right.
The one exception is the howler monkey.
The howler monkey. This is pretty spectacular. Yeah, so it's very clear that old world primates have this extra gene and this full color capability. And in surveys primatologists took, they realized that the howler monkey also had this ability. And when you track that ability to the DNA level, it turns out that the howler independently duplicated one of its genes, independently tuned those genes to the red and green spectrum. And in fact, the very same mutations had taken place in those howler genes that had taken place in our old world primate ancestors.
Even though they're not directly related to those old world
ancestors. No, they're not. And we know because of ways we can trace sort of the date of events in DNA that the howler event was much more recent and that the duplication that took place in the howler was clearly different from the duplication that took place in African apes. So we have a forensic record in DNA where we can tell when and how something happened as well. And it allows us to, you know, place these events in time in a, you know, really highly reliable way. And that's just a totally new way of reconstructing history.
That's fascinating to think about because, and what you're really saying is that evolution can repeat itself. It can keep sort of making the same kinds of mutations to adapt to similar circumstances, even though there's no direct relationship.
And the number of examples is now stunning. Again, I think something that biologists weren't suspecting until they were confronted with it in this new DNA era, that we have so many examples where either the exact same gene has changed in the same sort of way, or the exact same letter of DNA code in the exact same gene has changed in the exact same way in different species at different times in different parts of the world. And the message of that is that, well, when conditions are similar, that might be cold weather, that might be bright sunlight, that might be a particular type of pathogen or something like that, if there are individuals that have these mutations that confer a slight advantage, then evolution will work the same way again and again. It's much more predictable than we would have imagined.
So what it suggests is there's not as much variety in the evolutionary process of how different species may evolve than we previously thought.
Right. I think we thought everything was on its own trajectory and that sort of there were unique solutions in every circumstance. But we see common solutions coming up again and again and again. Color vision was one example.
Well, it's fascinating to think about this because there's this common notion that the evolutionary process is totally random. And that's not the case. That mutation may be random, but the actual selection process, sort of which genes survive, is not at all random.
Right. This is a really critical thing. I think it's the most common misconception about evolution is that this is a random process. It has this random component, but just as you described, that's mutation. There's nothing random about selection. One way to maybe draw an analogy that various people have come up with is think of a safecracker. So a safecracker is turning the wheels on that safe until it hears a click. The chance that you would crack a safe by just spinning the dials at random is virtually zilch. But if you have a chance to turn the dial through the various positions and wait for a click and then turn the next dial and listen for the click, then you can come up with the right combination pretty quickly. And that's really the way evolution works, which is selecting these incremental advantages and then cumulatively over time, many of those little incremental advantages add up to some pretty major differences, you know, between species and between higher groups of animals and other species.
Now, I'm wondering if this also suggests that there are actually fewer different genes out there than people used to think about. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that the range is narrower than maybe we once thought.
Yeah. Well, here's another news bulletin from studying DNA. The difference in let's just think of the genome. Genome is the DNA of a species, and the genes in there are sort of like a parts list. So if you look at a parts list for a mouse and you look at a parts list for a human, they are incredibly similar. So the genes that we have and the genes that a mouse has and a dog has and even a chicken has and even a pufferfish has, those parts lists are pretty similar, more similar than we imagine. Yet again, another surprise. So once you know that, it might not then be so stunning to realize that whether you're a snake adapting to the desert or you're a bird adapting to a desert, a mouse adapting to a desert, that some of those adaptations are going to be in common. So that's what we're finding because these animals share a whole lot of genes. You know, there's a second facet to that, which is, well, you know, if we talk about things like us and chimpanzees, mm-hmm. we're incredibly similar to chimpanzees.
What is it, 98% the same genes?
If you're reading the letter code, sort of, you know, reading left to right across the DNA, just taking into account typos, single letter changes, we're about almost 99% identical to chimpanzees. So we're incredibly similar to chimpanzees.
But that's astonishing to think about because then you're saying that 1% is critical because obviously humans and chimpanzees are wildly different.
Well, that 1% is critical. And there's two ways that that's critical. On the one hand, some of the things that we do are different from chimpanzees, probably in our physiology, you know, the way we digest something or probably especially the way we deal with pathogens. So the immune system is pretty different. But a lot of the rest of the genes are really, really similar. And you'd say, but wait a second, you know, it's hairier and it's got longer arms and how are we really different? Well, some of that is because the way differences in appearance evolve, we're beginning to appreciate it's not which genes you have, but how you use them. So this process, this choreography of using genes during the process of development, the making of an individual from an egg, small differences in when and where a gene is used can really add up to shape a little different shape skull, a little different arm length, a little body shape, a little curvature here, lack of curvature there, things like that.
When you say how a gene is used, what do you mean? What determines whether a gene is used one way or another?
Well, surrounding genes are pieces of DNA that don't encode proteins, but these are places where the instructions for where and when genes are turned on and turned off, this is where those instructions reside. In general, we'll just refer to them as genetic switches, because genes are turned on and off, sort of the way a light switch turns electricity on and off, that genes are used only at particular times and places in the body. So small changes in genetic switches can have pretty profound effects on the resulting animal. And one way to explain that 1% difference between chimps is to understand that small differences can mean a lot because of the way we're wired.
Sean Carroll is an evolutionary biologist at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and at the University of Wisconsin. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Do young scientists need a streak of arrogance to make great discoveries? Absolutely, says the still brash James Watson. In a minute, we'll hear from the Nobel Prize-winning biologist. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. James Watson occupies a unique place in the scientific pantheon. He's been one of the world's most famous scientists ever since he, along with Francis Crick, cracked the code for DNA more than half a century ago. He's also been a controversial figure, not shy about picking fights with other scientists, and not afraid to make inflammatory statements. But even Watson says he went too far when he suggested, in a recent interview, that certain racial groups are innately more intelligent than others. He later said he was mortified by his comments. So, what should we make of this self-proclaimed truth-teller? Does James Watson still have wisdom to offer the world of science? Well, you can judge for yourself. Steve Paulson talked with Watson about his book of advice for budding young scientists.
You title your book Avoid Boring People. And I certainly understand the impulse behind this statement. I mean, you'll learn more if you hang out with smart people. But I'm also wondering if there's a danger to that attitude, that I would think that that could very easily lead to arrogance and a kind of nasty
elitism.
Well,
I think you should expect young people to, you know, be arrogant if they have a bright idea and no one else believes in them. They got to convince themselves and then maybe a few others they're on the right track. But, you know, when you're old, arrogance isn't the way to succeed. You don't want to bore other people, and so you've got to, you know, teach them, educate them, make them laugh. When you're young, you know, I sometimes thought I'm not a very nice person. I just think about myself. But I think that's what my mother wanted me to do. She wanted me to be success. You know, when you're young, you should be sort of obsessive toward trying to prepare yourself to face the world.
So is that to say that when you were young, I mean, before you made your great discovery, that you offended a number of people?
Yes, because my parents let me say what I believed. And my sister was always afraid I'd get into trouble, but I thought honesty was fundamentally the, you know, if you can't be honest to people, just stay away from them.
But what about when your science career was starting to take off, and I mean, you were dealing with senior people at that time, did that ever create trouble for you?
Yes. But, you know, luckily, you know, my mentors were tolerant of my sort of ruthless honesty. And Francis Crick had the same thing. I think that's why we got along so well. You know, we felt the need to actually say things as they are.
Now, another bit of advice that you offer is never be the smartest person in the room. Tell me why.
Well, because you won't learn anything. Crick and I were trying to solve a chemical problem. We weren't trained in chemistry, but luckily in the same room was a much better chemist. And one day he said, "You got the formulas wrong." I was just copying them out of a book. And the next day we had the double helical structure of DNA. I think when you get old, it's a real tendency to not want to be criticized. And I think you always should be criticized. Hmm. Again, you know, you can say it's be gentle. No, you don't want to be gentle. You don't want people to be gentle with you when you're doing the wrong thing.
So partly what you're saying is set your sights high, especially if you're a budding scientist. I mean, go for...
Even if you're an old man like me, have high sights. You know, when I play tennis, you know, if once during an hour I can't hit a shot like Federer does, you know, routinely, I feel bad. And, you know, I now play in front of the baseline, and I've still got quick reactions. And so I just go for it. You know, go for the killer shot. Win. Hmm. So I think, you know, as a small boy, I wanted to win. And don't get into situations where you can't win or don't have a chance of winning. Of course, you know, if you know you're going to win all the time, it's not worth winning. So you got to just do something important.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it seems to me that raises some very practical questions for, especially for graduate students, for postdocs, and that's really the question of how ambitious do you want to be? Because if you really do shoot for the stars and you try to take on one of the big questions out there in science, you could fail. Your career could go nowhere. I mean, how do you weigh
Well, that? One of my rules is always have someone to save you when you failed. So someone's got to believe in you, and it's got to be more than your parents. You know, it's got to be someone who says, even if you fail, you've got the possibility of succeeding afterwards.
Is that ideally someone who's above you in rank?
Yes, of course. Yeah, someone who can pull strings and get you back in the system after the frontier has beaten you.
And you also suggest that if you're a graduate student, you're better off picking a young thesis advisor rather than someone who might be more established in the field.
Yeah, because you're more likely to be out at the frontier. And I think the frontier is where you want to be when you're young.
The Nobel Prize-winning biologist James Watson talking with Steve Paulson. So, are there many opportunities for budding young scientists? Well, plenty, as it turns out, if you listen to the kids who take part in national science competitions. And when I say kids, I really do mean it. 14, 15, and 16-year-olds who are making remarkable discoveries and inventing new technologies that could change our lives. Anne Strange Champs talked with two finalists in the Siemens competition in math, science, and technology, Sarah Waliani and Caroline Lang. Anne talked first with Sarah, who entered the team competition with her cousin.
We did this work at City of Hope, and we actually were studying breast tumor cells. We found that breast tumor cells that contain a protein called TDARP will actually become resistant to the major drug called Herceptin. This is a major problem because 20 to 30% of breast tumor patients are being treated with Herceptin, and the fact that they might not even respond to this drug if they contain TDARP is a major issue.
Now, how did you happen to pick breast cancer drug resistance as a topic to work on?
Both of us have very close friends whose mothers have suffered from breast tumor, and so it's affected our lives on a more personal level. And so when I actually applied for an internship at City of Hope, I asked to actually do a project dealing with breast tumor cells.
Explain more about what is TDARP?
It's actually a neuronal protein. It plays a role in like neurotransmitter signaling pathways. And that was kind of what was interesting, is that what is this protein that's normally found in the brain? What is it doing in these breast tumor cells?
Sarah, at the time you and Shalina took this on, how old were you?
I actually was 15 and she was 16.
I'm so struck by your confidence. I'm wondering, you know, what made you think that two high school girls might find a solution to a problem that professional oncologists were stumped by?
Actually, science has been a passion of my entire life, so I don't really find it surprising that teenagers can do this kind of work. I think if you have the passion for it, I think actually a teenager can do anything with this kind of passion.
So when you were actually working with TDARP in the lab, what were you doing?
I actually had to create the TDARP DNA, and then I had to basically do different experiments called electrophoresis to make sure that the TDARP was properly constructed and that it didn't have mutations. And then when I knew I had my TDARP DNA, I was able to start working with tumor cells, and so I actually had to put the DNA into these cells to study them.
And what was your biggest breakthrough?
I will never forget that night, actually, when I remember it was still like 8 p.m. and I was in the lab, and I was going to get my final results to find out if these cells, if they actually were resistant to Herceptin now that they contain TDARP. And so when I found, I used a machine called a spectrophotometer, and when the reading came out and I saw that the cells were in fact surviving, that means that they actually were resistant to Herceptin. That was definitely the breakthrough, and I remember my mentor and I were both very excited about finding that our suspicion of TDARP was actually correct.
So what you discovered can actually be used in the real world and may really help save women's lives?
I think it can, because if unfortunate breast tumor patients, if they're not responding to Herceptin because they contain this TDARP, then we need to find a different type of therapy that could possibly be more effective. And we can also see if there's a possibility of maybe blocking TDARP's effect so that they might be able to respond more effectively to Herceptin.
So, Caroline, how about you? Tell me something about your work and how you got involved in the Siemens competition.
My team, I have two other team members, Naomi and Rebecca, and we did our project in my kitchen, actually, because we're three best friends that are homeschooled. And our work involved developing a video system to automatically measure burger doneness. We did this because in the past 8 years, over 500,000 individuals have become infected with E. coli 0157H7.
500,000? I didn't know it was that many. Mm-hmm. So people are this is from people eating at fast food restaurants?
Yes, from ground beef. Ground beef is the number one cause. Some of the cases, I think 50,000 were from spinach and salad, but the majority were from ground beef cases. So that's where we got the idea to start this project.
And what made you even think about food poisoning as an issue to begin with?
Naomi works in a fast food restaurant. She's a cashier there, but she noticed that at her restaurant they use temperature probes to check the temperature of the burgers, and they only check a couple of the burgers, not even all of them, and they use the same temperature probe, so there's a risk of cross-contamination. So if only one burger was contaminated, the whole bunch would be contaminated.
Did Naomi come home from the fast food restaurant where she works and say, oh, gross, they're not even checked?
Yes, exactly. As part of our background research, we interviewed people in multiple fast food restaurants, and we found that only one of them was following the USDA guidelines. So it was just really scary what we found, and we found that something needed to be done about it.
So same question to you. You know, you discovered that this is a major food safety issue in an enormous multi-billion dollar industry. What made you think three teenage girls could take it on?
We knew we didn't have a lot of resources because we're homeschooled and we worked in our kitchen, but we just started it as a fun thing to do.
And you were how old at the time?
It was in ninth grade, so we were 14 and 15. And so we just thought, you know, why not try it? And it turned out really well, so...
So tell me what you did.
So we designed a video system that would hang above the grill of burgers, and it measures the shrinkage of the burgers while the burgers are cooking. And when the burgers have reached a certain size, it will tell the cook that the burgers are done, and then the cook will take them off. And this works because we found that shrinkage correlates with internal temperature. So when a burger reaches a certain size, it's safe internal temperature.
So you found a whole different way to measure the temperature of a burger, not using an old-fashioned thermometer and actually sticking it in the middle of the burger, but just looking at how much it was shrinking?
Exactly, yes. The problem with all methods today is that they touch the burger, and this causes cross-contamination, and it's also expensive because you have to buy a separate temperature probe for each burger, so there's no cross-contamination, and that's when we knew something had to be invented.
What was your biggest breakthrough?
We cooked hundreds and hundreds of burgers, and it seemed like there was never going to be an end. And finally, when we developed one system to measure the temperature so that we could correlate that temperature with shrinkage. We finally got good data. We put it on a graph in Excel. It fit what we needed, and it was just like an epiphany. It was amazing.
Is there any chance this could actually be used by restaurants in the fast food industry?
There's a great chance. We contacted 6 fast food restaurants and also the USDA, and they all expressed interest in our idea. So it's definitely something that could be implemented with a little bit more work.
Wow. So by the time you've reached the end of your teenage years, you may have a patent.
Yeah, we're hoping maybe that could come true. That would be amazing. But yeah.
The 3 of you are homeschooled, right? Was it? Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, you know, you didn't have the advantage of labs in a high school with lots of equipment and stuff. Was that a disadvantage for you, being interested in science?
Well, I just think that made us stronger because we had to work through so many problems with the budget because we didn't have expensive lab equipment. We didn't have a mentor with a lot of background in our area. It was just my mom who helped us. So we had to engineer all our own equipment. So I think it was a good thing. It helped us bond as a team working through all these obstacles.
So I'm curious, to the two of you, what would you say, especially to other girls? Because I know, you know that there's been attention from science educators and math educators over the last several years, you know, real concern that girls especially drop out of science and math early. This obviously hasn't been the case for you and for your teammates. Why do you think that hasn't been the case? What is it about science or about you that kept you involved?
I think that science fair is, I've been doing science fair since kindergarten. I think that's what my key role was because science textbooks, I mean, they're boring. That's all you can say about them. They're just boring. But science fair, when you actually get your hands on the work and are actually doing it for yourself, it's just an incredible experience. And it's just sparked my interest since I was young.
I've been also doing projects actually in my backyard because when I was 12, I couldn't actually get access to a lab. And so I started to do lettuce projects in my backyard, trying to increase the vitamin C content. And I think that if you sometimes just reading books, it's not really so interesting because you're just reading what other people have found. But if you're actually going to do experiment on your own and design your own hypothesis and try and test things that you know are important, then I think that it can actually make science a lot more interesting.
Sarah Wellianni and Caroline Lang, two of the finalists in the Siemens competition in math, science, and technology. They talked with Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you have thoughts on how to make science more interesting for kids? If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program DNA and Discovery, number 112A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.